Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're really getting into the math behind similarity, looking deep into sequences, you know, the stuff that makes up modern data. Think about those long random sequences in genetic codes or text strings or algorithms. How do mathematicians actually pin down how similar two sequences are?
Well, the main idea, the bedrock concept here, is what's called the longest common subsequence. LCS for short. So if you have two sequences, maybe two strands of DNA, $6, the LCS is the longest string of characters you can find in both, keeping them in their original order. Its length, we call it LCNLR. That's our basic measure of similarity.
Okay, and this LCNL, it's not just some abstract number, right? It's practical. It tells you something about the cost of changing one sequence into the other.
Exactly. Yeah, it's directly tied to what's called the Levenshtein distance or edit distance. For sequences of length NALR, the minimum number of insertions or deletions needed to get from one to the other. That's precisely 2NL is 2LCNLR.
Ah, I see. So the longer the common part, the less work you need to do to make them match. Makes sense. But today, we're getting pretty abstract here. We're not just looking at one pair of sequences. We want to know what happens in the long run, right? As these sequences get incredibly long, towards infinity, we're after the asymptotic behavior.
That's the goal, yeah. And when we talk asymptotics, there are really two big questions. First, as NALR gets huge, what's the average length?
Hmm.
Does LCNLR grow linearly with NALRs? And if it does, what's that constant ratio? And second, this is the much trickier part, what's the limiting law? So if you measure LCNLRs over and over, what's the actual shape of the probability distribution? Those little fluctuations around the average. Is it a nice bell curve or something weirder?
Okay, and we're looking at two different ways to measure this similarity today, two sort of mathematical beasts. The standard LCS and then a more restricted version.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the one that apparently leads to some really complex math. The longest common increasing subsequence, or LCIE numbers.
Right, LCINDL. This one's tough because it throws in a big constraint. The subsequence doesn't just have to be common to both strings. But if your alphabet has some kind of order, like numbers, Wendy, now, or to now, the common sequence itself has to be weakly increasing.
Weakly increasing.
Right.
So like if I find 4, 2, 7, 50s in both sequences in that order, LCINLN won't count it because it goes down then up.
Exactly. It fails the increasing test.
I'd need to find something like 2, 5, 5, 8. So it has to respect the built-in order of the numbers themselves. Wow, that sounds like it would really cut down the possibilities.
Oh, it does. It's a huge reduction.
Yeah.
And that constraint makes the whole system behave in, well, deeply non-trivial ways. Even just figuring out the average length is hard. The sources show the average ratio, LCINNDLRs, it converges almost surely to a fixed value. We call it Enochsdahl.
And the CMaxDahl, the definition sounds complicated. Maximizing some sum of minimums involving the probabilities of the letters, PSPYL, sounds like you need to consider every letter, right?
That's what you'd think.
Yeah.
But here's the first big surprise the research throws up. There's this lemma 1.6. It shows that to actually calculate that maximum Mmax, you only need to focus on two letters from the whole alphabet.
Wait, hang on. Just two. You're saying when the sequences get infinitely long, the average similarity ratio Emax is determined just by the best pair of letters you can pick, the two that give you the best increasing match.
That's right.
Why? Why do all the other letters just fade away mathematically?
Well, think about it. The system's trying to build the longest increasing sequence it can. When dollars is enormous, the most efficient way to do that, it turns out, is to find two letters that pop up often enough and just kind of lock onto them, maybe alternate between them or stick with one for a while, the other letters. They either don't show up enough or they mess up the increasing pattern. So asymptotically, they become like noise. The system finds the optimal path relies only on the best two candidates.
That's, wow, I really need simplification out of all that complexity. Okay, so we have the average Emax driven by just two letters. Now, the fluctuations around it, what's the shape? Is it the central limit theorem, the Gaussian bell curve we usually see?
No, absolutely not. This is where that increasing constraint really shows its teeth. The limiting distribution isn't simple at all. It's described by something quite complex,
mm-hmm.
A functional of two independent multidimensional Brownian motions.
Okay, hold on. Brownian motion, that's like random walks, right? The jiggling path of a dust particle.
Sort of, yeah. It's a continuous random process. Multidimensional means you have several of these random paths moving, potentially influencing each other in a higher dimensional space.
And a functional of that, what does that mean for someone trying to picture this?
A functional is like a rule. It takes that entire complicated history, the whole random path traced out by these Brownian motions, and it maps all of that complexity down to a single number. That number represents the probability of seeing the certain LCI known anole length.
So the chance of getting a particular LCI anole length doesn't just depend on simple averages. It depends on the whole accumulated, tangled, random history of how the letters appeared in the sequences.
You got it. The history matters immensely. That constraint forces this deep connection between the discrete letter structure and these continuous random processes. We can see it in the specific cases.
Okay, let's look at those. What if the letters are just uniformly random? Every letter from $1 to $1 has the same chance, like rolling a dollar-sided die.
Uniform case, then Emacs is just $1 to $1. Right. Makes sense, right? Equal chance for everything. And the limiting law. It involves a functional of m-dimensional standard Brownian motions. The dimension of the random process matches the full alphabet size.
Okay, nuller dimensions for nuller letters, if uniform. Now, what if the probabilities aren't uniform, but they're the same for both sequences? Say, letter 3 appears 50% of the time, and the others split the rest.
Right, identical non-uniform distributions. Then Emacs simplifies nicely. It just becomes Qmax, the probability of the most frequent letter, so 0.5 in your example. But here's the cool part about the distribution shape. The limiting law now uses a functional of two-dimensional Brownian motions. And Timidax isn't Tak anymore. It's the number of letters that share that top probability Pmax door.
Ah, so if only one letter hits that 50% peak, Tepeter is axis. If maybe two letters both had the highest probability, say 30% each, then two letters would be two.
Exactly. The dimension of the underlying chaos is set only by the structure of the probability peak, not the whole alphabet. The system focuses its complexity there.
Fascinating. So the complexity shrinks down to just the most likely letters. And there was something about invariance, too.
Yeah. Another interesting point from the source is, in some specific scenarios, the asymptotic distribution, that Brownian functional thing, it actually doesn't care how you order the blocks. Increasing, decreasing, the shape stays the same, which is kind of surprising.
Okay. So LCI annuller, the increasing version, leads us down this path of complex, multidimensional Brownian functionals, very sensitive to the input probabilities, highly structured chaos. No. Let's take that increasing constraint off. Let's go back to the standard longest common subsequence, LCN annullers. No ordering rules, just find the longest common part. What does its asymptotic behavior look like?
Well, moving from LCN annullers is almost like moving from something complex but known to something that seems simpler but is actually full of mysteries.
Mysteries, like how the average length ratio ALCN annullers, which converges to some constant gamma, that constant isn't even known for the simplest case, like binary sequences.
That's right. It's one of the big unsolved constants in this area. People have estimates, but no exact value. But the real action, the focus of recent research, has been on the variance, the fluctuations. Because that tells us about the distribution's shape.
Okay, the variance. How much LCI annuller typically deviates from its average? What do we know?
We know it can't grow too fast. Steele's inequality gives an upper bound. The variance, text var LCN, grows it most linearly with $9. So ordered on the ball.
But the lower bound, that's been the tricky part, the big debate for years, hasn't it?
It really has. Everyone kind of believes, based on simulations and combinatorial arguments, that the variance should also grow linearly from below. The text var LCN should be bigger than or equal to some constant dollars, $9. So genuinely order another dollar.
Mm.
But proving that, especially for uniform random words, has been incredibly difficult. Yet that assumption that the variance is linear is absolutely critical for what comes next.
Okay, so here's the payoff. Assuming that the variance is indeed linear, that it's less than dollars, what does that tell us about the limiting distribution of LCI annullers?
This is where it gets really interesting, based on recent work by Houdre and Eastlack. If you assume that linear variance, then LCI annuller follows the good old central limit theorem, the LT.
The bell curve. So if the variability is high enough linear in dollar, the fluctuations just average out into a standard normal, a Gaussian distribution.
Exactly. You center it, scale it by the square root of the variance, which is proportional to the square, and the variance is $7, and boom, Gaussian limit. It suggests a kind of universality where the fine details wash out.
Okay, but hang on. This Gaussian result feels almost too simple, especially when you compare it to a very similar problem. Finding the LCS not of random words, but of random permutations. That leads somewhere else entirely, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, and that's the crucial distinction. Remember, random words can have repeated characters, like A, B, A, C, C. Random permutations use each symbol exactly once, like 1, 3, 2, 4. When you look at the LCS of two independent, uniform, random permutations, the problem mathematically transforms into a different, very famous problem, finding the longest increasing subsequence of a single permutation.
Ah, long a dollar. And that's famous because it doesn't follow the central limit theorem. That's the connection to random matrix theory from the 90s, right?
Precisely. The Wintle-Lehrer problem, and by extension the LCS of permutations, doesn't give you a Gaussian. It gives you the Tracy-Wedham distribution, a much more exotic shape, first found in the behavior of large random matrices.
So we have this stark contrast. LCS for words potentially gives Gaussian CLT. LCS for permutations gives Tracy-Wedham F222. What's the fundamental reason for this difference? What's the mathematical switch?
It all comes down to the variance, the magnitude of the variance. In the permutation case, the little letter of the structure is very rigid. The average length only grows like 2/4, much slower than linear. And critically, the variance, the fluctuations around that average are tiny. They scale like un-$13, and that's sublinear.
It's much, much smaller than my dollar.
Right. Because the variability is so small, so constrained, the system doesn't have enough randomness wiggle room to average out into a Gaussian. The underlying constraints dominate, leading to the specific Tracy-Wedham shape.
Whereas for random words, the assumption is that the variance is linear, order non-dollars, much larger fluctuations.
Exactly. If that assumption holds, the larger linear variance means there's enough randomness, enough noise piling up, that the system gets pushed towards the universal Gaussian tractor of the CLT.
So the amount of inherent randomness, the size of the fluctuations, dictates whether you land in the Gaussian world or the Tracy-Wedham world or maybe somewhere else.
That's the core idea. High variability, linear variance suggests CLT. Low constrained sublinear variance suggests more exotic distributions like Tracy-Wedham, often linked to specific structures.
Okay, let's try to wrap this up. What does this journey tell us? We've seen these two different sequence comparison measures behave quite differently. LCI null, with its increasing rule, gets incredibly complex. Its distribution defined by these Brownian functionals that really depend on the input probabilities, very structure dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Then standard LCN dollars for random words. It might actually be governed by the universal central limit theorem if its variability is high enough, linear and nullerm, more like a general statistical averaging process.
It really highlights how sensitive these things are. A small change in the rules, adding the increasing constraint or change in the input type words versus permutations, fundamentally changes the deep mathematical character of the problem and its limiting statistics. You jump between these different universality classes.
And the whole story for the standard LCS, the one most people probably think of first, seems to hang by a thread, that one assumption about the variance.
It really does. That's the provocative final thought here. The ultimate fate, the true limiting law for LCN dollars in random words, rests entirely on settling that conjecture. Is the variance truly linear in $1, or is it smaller, maybe doing? If someone proved tomorrow that the variance is actually sublinear, the argument for the Gaussian limit collapses instantly, and it would open the door wide to finding a non-Gaussian limit, perhaps something related to Tracy-Wedham again, or something entirely new.
So the amount of randomness inherent in the comparison itself, that magnitude remains the key unresolved question that defines the ultimate mathematical nature of this fundamental similarity problem.
Precisely. It's a fantastic example of how deep questions in probability theory connect directly to understanding patterns in data.